Over the course of his career so far, Stephen Sondheim has brought to life characters that range from New York street gangs to witches and enchanted woods, artists and presidential assassins. And last year, he was here to discuss his career in the first volume of his collected lyrics, and he joins me now to discuss the second volume, which he has called Look, I Made a Hat, Collected Lyrics 1981-2011, with attendant comments, amplifications, dogmas, harangues, digressions, anecdotes, and miscellany. It's published by Knopf, and I'm very pleased that it brings Stephen Sondheim back to our show today. And you sure know how to write a subtitle.
Thanks. Yeah, they're fun.
This volume picks up where Finishing the Hat left off and begins with your first collaboration with James Lapine and Sunday in the Park with George. We just listened to Sunday from that. How did you meet him?
I saw a play down at what I call the Joe Papp Theater down at the New York Shakespeare Festival. It was called 12 Dreams. He wrote and directed it. It was based on a single sentence, I believe, anyway, a short passage, from the writings of Carl Jung. Jung had treated a young girl in her, I think, prepubescent, actually, who had had 12 dreams presaging her own death, and she died. And Lapine, with his taste for the macabre and also for the setting, wrote and directed this play, and I was knocked out by it, and I wanted to meet him and see if he'd be interested in collaborating on a musical. But I was too shy to do it because there are a lot of playwrights who look down on musicals, and I didn't want to put him in an uncomfortable position. Also, I didn't know he might have liked musicals but not mine, et cetera, et cetera. So I never approached him. But coincidentally, within a few months, I got a call from Lewis Allen, who was a producer, who said, I have a young friend, a playwright, who would love to meet you because he'd like to do a musical with you. And indeed, it was James Lapine, who had a very specific idea of something he wanted to do.
Which was Sunday in the Park?
No. It was a book by Nathaniel West, and it was
Miss Lonely Hearts.
No. You've just driven it out of my mind.
Yeah.
He only wrote four books. It's the Depression story. It's the Candide story translated to Depression. And James made a play of it called Luck, Pluck, and Virtue, which is all I can remember at the moment. It's not Balzo Snell, and it's not
I know. Yeah. It's that Hollywood one.
Anyway. No, it's not the Hollywood. It's not the Hollywood. It's the other one. At any rate. So he came to the house, and we started to talk. And out of that series of discussions, we met over a period of a couple of months. And out of that came Sunday in the Park with George.
Well, you've talked about how much you like collaborating, but is it different with each person?
Oh, sure. Of course it is. The nice thing about, and the interesting thing for me about working with James, was that he was a younger generation. I'd always worked with people either of my own generation or just slightly below me. But James was brought up in another playwriting generation. The playwrights of the 60s who came of age in the 60s and started to break down the conventions of theatrical presentation and of storytelling and of playwriting. Also, he came from an off-Broadway background. His plays had been done at the Shakespeare Festival and at Playwrights Horizons. He was not a Broadway baby the way I was. And so that contrast on both those levels was enormously stimulating to me. And it reminded me of what fun it is to put on a show when you don't have millions of dollars riding on it and you have a lot of backers that you feel guilty about.
So that was an inexpensive play to mount?
At Playwrights Horizon, it certainly was.
By 1981, you'd been in theater for over 25 years. You'd worked on 11 Broadway shows. You had developed a style, hadn't you?
The style always reflected and always does with me reflect the librettist, the book writer. I wrote different kinds of... first of all, I do not like to repeat myself in terms of either subject or ambience with a show if I can possibly avoid it. And, I believe in the old adage that you should do something that frightens you. If you're too comfortable with what you're writing, it tends to come out flatter. And I try as hard as I can to overcome the fear and to go and plunge into something that is foreign territory to me. And the method of working at off Broadway, and first of all, it was like Mickey and Judy putting on a show. It was wonderful to work at Playwrights Horizons.
My guest is Stephen Sondheim, who's written another book called "Look, I Made a Hat." It's published by Knopf. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. Well, it's a musical about artistic creation. So was it more personal than some of the other things you've written?
Not really. All shows are personal in a way. They're never specifically or rarely specifically personal. The only time I've ever been specifically personal was in Merrily We Roll Along, which is about, at one point, about two young songwriters. It was personal in the sense that it's about the creative act, and as a creative actor, as a creative artist, I was writing from something that I've experienced and that I feel deeply about. So in that sense, it was personal.
And in fact,
Finishing the Hat is the personal statement of it. Not the book, but the song.
You won the Pulitzer Prize for... Not the book, but the song.
I should
listen to what my guests say.
That's okay.
You want to elucidate on that?
Well, no. Finishing the Hat is the Georges Seurat character, mm-hmm. who is the hero of the first act, has trouble aligning his personal life with his professional life, and he is in the process of losing his mistress. And also in the process of painting Sunday Afternoon on the Island of the Grand Jatte. And he has had an argument with her over the fact that she wanted him to take her out. He had promised to, but he has to finish the hat. It's the hat on the figure on the right-hand side of the painting. And so he's in the park, and he's musing to himself and going over the sketches that he's made during the day. And his mistress, Dot, already has a new boyfriend. And he is lamenting the fact that he can't put the two parts of his life together and that he's always finishing a hat.
You won a Pulitzer for Sunday in the Park with George. You've won Tonys and an Oscar and many honorary awards. Awards are important to everybody because they are kind of an affirmation.
Well, I cover that in the new book.
That's why I brought it up.
Oh, right, yeah, right. No, I said
I asked you as a kind of faux innocent question.
Yeah. I said awards are good for three things: for boosting the ego, for sometimes for money, and for bric-a-brac. Uh-huh. And that the only kind of awards that really count are the ones that are for money. Uh-huh. That come with money, I should say.
But
others
Tony's
are sometimes good for the ego and fill up your mantelpiece. But money is what makes the artist go round.
Were you so eager to work with James Lapine again after Sunday in the Park with George because the collaboration had been quite enjoyable?
Exactly. And had such a terrific time with him, and it was a wholly different kind of collaboration than I experienced before. And also, James is a writer and director.
Which can be a problem sometimes.
Well, I suppose it can be, but not in James's case, because you're writing with somebody who is conceiving the way it looks at the same time he is writing it, and as opposed to the two people doing that, it's not so much that it saves time, but I think what it does is give the work more of an integrated, that awful word, an integrated feeling that it really feels of a piece, of a texture.
But where did the idea for Into the Woods come from?
Idea of Into the Woods came because we had discussed doing a television show, a television special in which all the characters from television in those days would meet in a hospital and run into, Jackie Gleason would meet Lucille Ball, would meet Carol Burnett, would meet all the big TV stars in their characters would meet. And we hoped to sell that idea to Norman Lear, who was a very imaginative television producer.
All in the Family, I noticed.
Yeah, exactly. And All in the Family. And he said, sure, go ahead and write it. And we said, no, we want to just sell the idea to you. He said, oh, no, I'm sorry. No, write it, and we'll see what we do. But out of that came the notion. I'd always wanted to do a Quest musical, something, along the lines of The Wizard of Oz, a fairy tale with a quest in it. And James started to try to write that. And he gave up after a few days of attempt because he said there are no parameters. You can just go anywhere when you're making up a tale like that. He said, but how about if we took some of the fairy tale characters that we know and did with them what we were talking about with the hospital thing. And so that's exactly what he did, and he invented a story that tied them all together.
Their realizations of the realization that they make when they're in the woods.
Yes. Well, the woods, you know, as every psychologist has told you, you know, the woods in fairy tales are the unconscious, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. They have different. Everybody thinks we took it from Bettelheim. It had nothing to do with Bettelheim at all. It's just Bettelheim is the only really popularizer of the fairy tale myth ideas. And actually, what we did, we actually consulted a Jungian analyst about the origins of fairy tales.
And you write about Joanna Gleason's insight into her character, the baker's wife. Is it unusual to have an actor make those kinds of connections about a whole piece rather than just their particular character?
Well, it's not that she made a connection. She just made a very imaginative suggestion based on her approach to the I won't say the problems she was having of acting the character, but the concomitants of what performing the role was, which is, she said, and it was an offhand remark. It wasn't that I was trying to solve a problem. It's just that in talking about it one night, she had the insight into her own character. She said, "I feel like I'm in the wrong story." And I thought, oh, boy, what a good line for a song. And so I used it. But she had that insight.
My guest is Stephen Sondheim, who's written a book called Look, I Made a Hat, Collected Lyrics, 1981-2011, with attendant comments, amplifications, dogmas, harangues, obsessions, anecdotes, and miscellany. It's published by Knopf, and we will continue our conversation after we listen to a little bit of music and then take a break.
Let us meet the moment unblushed. Life is often so unpleasant. You must know that as a peasant, best to take the moment present as a present for the moment. This was just a moment in the woods, our moment, shimmering and lovely and sad. Leave the moment, just be glad for the moment.
Never comes to see me, hardly ever calls. When he sends me letters, they're just two lines scrawls. Isn't he something? Things he says out loud.
Isn't He Something from Roadshow is a beautiful song. Would you say is your tribute to Harold Arlen? Was he one of your favorite composers?
He certainly was.
Now, why do you try to write an Arlen-esque song for each show?
Oh, I don't. I say I do that. It's just because I can't resist stealing from him. And, you know, it's not that stealing's a particular motifs or anything like that, but just the style and the harmonic language just kills me. He's just wonderful, and he's so imaginative. So when I say I'm trying to put it out, it's just that what I really mean is that his kind of harmonic language creeps in no matter what I write.
Now, if I remember his story, didn't he start off as a lyricist who then started writing the music as
well? Gee, I didn't know that.
Well, maybe that's another.
He was, I know he was a pit pianist, rehearsal pianist, and wrote Get Happy, and somebody heard it and said, hey, fellow, that's a good one. Why don't we put it in our review?
But were you writing music all along, or did you...
All along from...
I mean, when you were just working as a lyricist.
No, I started. In school, in high school, I started writing musicals. Prior to that, I'd met Oscar Hammerstein and wanted to be what he was, but really what that meant was as a songwriter, not lyric writer necessarily. I'd studied piano and, music was very much a part of what I liked doing.
Well, Hammerstein did team with some pretty great
composers.
Composers, sure, and so did you.
Yes, indeed.
You revealed that in the course of writing a show, you cry once and only once. What does it usually?
I don't know. It's really hard. I was talking to a friend today about just that, about... a moment in Merrily We Roll Along. I don't know. I have no idea, but I can usually pinpoint the moments when it happened.
Is it finding the right word or phrase?
Yes, that's part of it. It is that, but it's obviously it's got something to do with whatever the subject is at the moment. And, you know, I'm, remember in Follies, it was the word home in the song called The Right Girl. And in Sunday, it was the word forever in the song Sunday.
You mean you were struggling to find the right word, and then
well,
it came, and
it
suddenly...
came. Well, but it's not the struggle that did it. It's just hitting the word. It may have been, I think it was. I don't remember struggling with either of those in either of those cases. Just as I wrote it, suddenly, what the song was about. You know, it has to do with much more than just the word. It has to do with what the song is about and what you've been feeling emotionally as you've been writing the song. You know, and what you feel for the character. And in the case of The Right Girl, it was because I knew what Buddy was feeling when he was thinking about how unhappy he was at home and how he wanted a home and what he was going through. And in the case of Sunday in the Park with George, it was something that Lupine had pointed out to me, which is all these people are strolling around the park. They have no idea they're going to be immortalized.
Mm-hmm.
No, they're just walking around in a park, and they have no idea that 100 years hence somebody's going to be looking at them.
Well, it sounds to me like you get involved in your characters, that you actually act out the characters.
Very. I'm an actor monkey. I'm a playwright monkey, too.
Yeah, and we've been talking about what inspired some of the pieces. It sounds to me like it doesn't start with a thought. But what about something like Sunday? That is about a painting. Passion was inspired by a movie based on a book, wasn't it?
Yeah, yeah.
So... did you see the movie and say,
I saw the movie and on Fosca's first entrance, the leading lady's first entrance, I just thought, oh, boy, would this make a musical.
But no way could you know that Donna Murphy would be...
No, I had not heard of Donna Murphy at that point. No.
So what happens when you've done something and then the absolute right person shows up for the part?
It's remarkable. I remember Donna's audition. I was ready, as far as I'm concerned, she could have gone on the stage that night. I mean, she had an insight and a feeling for the character, an insight into what Fosca is about. And Fosca is a moderately complex woman who's, you know, who, at least as far as I know, is completely different than Donna as a woman. But Donna locked in there somehow, and it was apparent. It wasn't just her skills. Her skills are fine. But there are a lot of people with skills. But she zeroed in on that character with no coaching from James or me.
It's interesting that you said earlier you always liked the challenge, and Passion followed Assassins, a very different
mm-hmm.
kind of show.
Mm-hmm.
Was that one of the reasons you wanted to do this?
No. In fact, I don't even remember how the timing worked out.
Because this is the closest you've come to writing an opera or an operetta.
I suppose so. No, but content dictates form, as I say repeatedly in the books. And if you're going to tell an operatic story like Passion, like the novel is called Fosca, which is, you know, it's about an over-the-top woman of over-the-top emotions, although it was based on a real story. You know, the author had experienced this. Apparently, Fosca was an epileptic, and he'd fallen in love with her. And he never names the disease in the book, in the novel itself, but he created as many 19th century novelists did an exaggerated world, a melodramatically colored world. He took his own experiences and made them into a 19th century novel because he was living in the 19th century, and. That over-the-top quality bespeaks opera as opposed to musicals, I think. And so that's why Passion has a vaguely operatic feeling. It's more of an operetta, really, but a serious operetta, which most operettas are not.
And it was made into a film, an Italian film.
Oh, yeah, that's what I saw. I didn't read the book until long after I'd seen
the film. But that film came out of the Visconti kind of operatic cinema.
Well, yes. Well, I suppose, except really that's just about the fact that it was a costume drama and took place, you know, in the late 19th century. But the character is that. But the overall treatment of Scola, the director's point of view was not the same as Visconti. It's curious enough, in a way, it's realistic if you can think of realism as applied to a late 19th century story about the military.
Well, I'm glad you bring up realism, because isn't there a certain surreality or whatever word I could come up with there, that's inherent in musicals simply because characters burst into song throughout the action of a play?
Oh, sure, but the characters themselves are rarely to be taken seriously. And the incidents that happen to them, I mean, you know, we take the characters in, let's say, Follies seriously, but it doesn't have the same operatic feeling, partly because it takes place in contemporary society. You know, operas generally are more convincing as operas, I think, when they take place in either a Never Never Land or a time distant in the past. But if you're going to deal with, as we dealt with in Follies and Company, with people who are maybe over the top a bit, but they are contemporary people, then it doesn't quite compute the same way. Whereas Little Night Music, which takes place at the turn of the century, the turn of the 20th century,
based on another film,
but also in a foreign country, then it has an operetta feeling to it, and because the people are quaint, if that's the right word.
Only you and Woody Allen would ever consider doing an adaptation of a Bergman film.
Oh, I don't think that's true. I think other people would do it, too.
You spend almost a quarter of the book describing the evolution of Wise Guys, which became Bounce and eventually Roadshow. Is that evolutionary span in at least four incarnations unusual for a show?
Oh, sure it is. It was really four distinct shows, one after the other, each one deriving from the one before it. But it's extremely unusual, and for two authors to spend 10 years plus, not steadily on the piece, but over a period of 10 years plus, is extremely unusual.
And then you had three different directors: Al Prince, John Doyle, who brought other things to each project.
Sam Mendes, and the directors influenced the way we thought about the show in each case, and it wasn't until we got to Doyle that it all locked in properly and became the piece we wanted it to be.
In introducing the Bounce phase of the evolution, you discuss your worries that by using vaudeville in the musical that you might fall into irony. Something of a trap for a songwriter to fall
into? No. If I said that, then I misspoke. It's not into irony. It's a kind of easy pastiche irony. The song is making the comment that the style of the song is making a comment on the material, which is wrong for that show.
Mm-hmm.
Just wrong.
It turned out
to be wrong.
You reveal that you write lying down when you're composing?
I try to write away from the piano as much as possible, because if you write at the piano, you're limited by your own technique, and my technique is, you know, mediocre at the piano.
Didn't hurt Irving Berlin.
No, but he was trying to write different kinds of things than I do. The problem is your fingers fall into the same chords. Don't forget, Berlin also had people who arranged his music for him. So he would say, no, that's not the harmony I want. That's the harmony. Oh, that's a nice one. If you write at the piano, your muscle memory keeps... When I do write at the piano, I always try to write in a key I haven't written in a long time. And some keys are more difficult than others, and so I try to usually go into those. But I've tried to train myself to write away from the piano on the couch. And I never write a whole song that way, of course. Unlike a lot of so-called classical musicians, I need the piano to check myself, and also it's fun to fiddle at the piano. But if you can think of your basic motifs or harmonic structures away from the piano, and then go to the piano and fiddle with them, it gives you a different springboard than the song you'd written the day before, though I should say the month before.
You say that you enjoy composing more than writing lyrics.
Well, sure, because it's freer. I mean, the English language is a wonderful language, but it has its restrictions.
But you write such great lyrics.
Well, thank you very much. But, you know, and there are only 88 keys on the piano, so to speak. But it seems to me that the varieties of music are greater than the varieties that you can get with language, in given that you're writing songs. Now, if you're writing books, then you have much greater scope of variety of the use of the language, much more.
You know that no matter what you write, people are going to come away saying there was that brilliant turn of phrase.
Well, yeah, maybe they will. I don't really try that. Certainly the playfulness of the English language is something I think is underused or underutilized anyway on the stage, and it's partly because it's hard to play with it properly. You know, it's like juggling.
Now, I've spoken to a number of playwrights, Edward Albee, David Rabe, mm-hmm. others, who have complained about the New York Reviewers and the impact that it's had on their careers. They left town at mm-hmm. certain points in their careers. Roadshow did not get great reviews.
No, didn't.
What was your...
I got much worse reviews for... My own personal reviews on Funny Thing Happened the Way the Forum, and even on West Side Story, my personal reviews were terrible. And Gypsy, they were mostly terrible. And Forum.
Great shows.
Well, that's your opinion, but not theirs. And certainly my contribution, even the ones that liked West Side Stories, took pot shots at me. You have to outlive your critics as well. Now it's in a way it's easier if you're writing musicals, because musicals are such coin of the realm over the last 50 years as opposed to the 50 years preceding it, where plays were, if anything, even more popular. That's one thing. And secondly, you're working in a collaborative situation. So sure, they didn't like the lyrics to West Side Story, but they sure loved the choreography.
Well, today, of course, people are still singing those songs, and people get all teary-eyed with "I'm So Pretty" or "Maria."
And the reviewers claim, "Oh, yes, I always liked it," but then you look at what they wrote, and they didn't.
There are a few instances here where you recycled material written for one show, put it in another, which isn't something you've done very often. Is that because you draw so much from the source material?
Every score has its own. Tone, so to speak, just the way every show has its own tone, and I write specifically for the characters in that show and the situations in that show. I have on two, I think, occasions only, maybe three, I can't remember at the moment, utilized a musical idea or a musical motif, and in one case, a whole chunk of musical motifs in another show, but rarely.
Although almost every composer and lyricist has recycled material. Cole Porter, Lawrence Hart,
Oscar
Hammerstein.
But I don't.
Stephen Sondheim's Look, I Made a Hat, Collected Lyrics, 1981-2011, with attendant comments, amplifications, dogmas, harangues, digressions, anecdotes, and miscellany, is published by Knopf. And he will be in conversation with Frank Rich tonight at 7 o'clock at the Queen's College. For more information and tickets, go to our show page at WMIC.org. He'll also be speaking with Anna Quinlan at the Union Square Barnes & Noble store this Wednesday at 7 o'clock. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you, Leonard.
Talking with you.
Yeah, it always is to talk to you, too.
Look, I made a hat. Well, there never was a hat.